time now for the nationally syndicated radio show, The World of Lori Zook. And now, here she is, the smart, the sexy, the savvy, Divine Miss Z.
And welcome to the show. I'm so glad you're joining us today because I have a Masters and Legends special for you. I have musician Russ Kassoff joining me from New York today. Now, Russ is also a conductor, a producer, and arranger, and he's performed with a slew of celebrities over the years, including Frank Sinatra and Liza Minnelli. So, Russ, I want to welcome you to the show.
Oh, I'm so delighted to be here. It's wonderful to join you, and I must tell you, I've listened to some of your interviews, and they're great. I've really enjoyed myself.
Well, thank you, Russ. And we're going to make yours great, too, because I've done some research on you, and I've listened to your CDs. And I know when we previously spoke on the phone, you, I think, said that you were sort of the guy who maybe should have been famous, but no one really knows who you are. And I agree. More people should know who you are.
Well, I'm glad you agree. I've had a very fortunate career and played for a lot of different people, but I'm just not able to hold a steady job. I mean, it's just one gig at a time.
I think that's what all musicians tell me they have to do is find one gig at a time.
That's right. I've only had like two real steady jobs in my life. You might count three if you count Sinatra.
Okay.
But there were long periods of time that he didn't work, and I worked for long periods of time with Liza concurrently. But my longest steady job was playing piano at the top of the World Trade Center, Windows on the World, the old World Trade Center, and it was a magnificent restaurant, and it was an amazing gig. It was 5 hours a night, 5 nights a week.
Well, and you know what? I remember that. I've been there. My family is from New York City, and I remember that restaurant very well. So I've probably met you and not even realized it.
Well, now we meet again. I actually remember you because you're the one that left the $2 tip.
Oh, no. I always give the big tips, Russ.
You wanted the Sondheim medley.
Made me laugh on that. Well, let's go back to the very, very beginning. You know, growing up, when did you know you wanted to be a musician? Did you come from a musical family?
Well, I have a really great story for you for that.
Okay.
My family wasn't very musical. They were music fans. So my parents listened to the old WNEW in New York, mm-hmm. which was the Sinatra channel, the make-believe ballroom, Williams B. Williams, the Great American Songbook. And so whenever we went on trips in the car and I was in the back seat, that was my first exposure to music. They weren't musicians, but they were very supportive when they realized that I had a little bit of talent. They bought me a little toy, Tinker Toy piano, and I started playing with Bugs Bunny cartoons. And there was a Bugs Bunny cartoon in which the whole cartoon was he comes out and he plays an abbreviated version of Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody No. 2. You know, ba-da, ba-da-da-da. And I started playing along with it. So they found a way to get me lessons, and I studied with a sort of a beginner teacher who recognized that I had some kind of talent, and I only lasted a year with him because I outgrew him, and he recommended me to a very fine classical music teacher, and my parents spent their life savings, they weren't rich, on a spinet piano so that I could take lessons and practice. And the teacher actually gave me a scholarship as one of her students, and I learned some classical music. But to answer the question, the specific question that you just asked, is when did I decide I wanted to be a musician?
Right.
When my mother was pregnant with my next brother 4 years later in 1957, my father wanted to get out of the house. So he took me to a live performance of the Steve Allen Show in the Millennium Hotel in New York. And he and I were sitting in the audience. I'm 4 years old. I had already been taking lessons. And I'm watching the band, and I was just so mesmerized. You know how everybody, when technology with television, got mesmerized as mm-hmm. they looked at the monitor, and if they saw themselves in the monitor, oh, my God, you know, that's so exciting.
I'm on TV.
Nowadays everybody has a monitor. But back then, it was very unusual and special, so you were all excited. And Steve Lawrence, who was somebody that Steve Allen discovered along with Edie Gourmet and was a regular on that show, this was after The Tonight Show, the original Tonight Show. came out to sing, Portrait of My Love. And the band was playing cards. He was singing live. The band was playing cards. I remember Skitch Henderson standing at the podium, looking like he was conducting. And when I saw that, I said, this is what I want to do.
That's a good moment. I had a whole visual on that. And as a four-year-old, that had to be really exciting. You know, that
well,
young to know.
Well, I didn't understand that the band had pre-recorded the track.
in those
days, it was all to tape. And why would a live band pre-record the track? When you were a little kid, you'd think a live band would want to play live. Nowadays, they play live.
Right.
And back then, you know, I just thought it was interesting that, you know, you could just sit there, be a musician, not play.
And play cards.
Yeah, right. So, like, from that point forward, I pretty much knew that I was going to be a musician. I never had to make a decision on anything else.
Now, how did that progress throughout your life? So now you know you want to be a musician. You are taking lessons. You're going through, you know, grammar school, elementary school, through high school. How does that progress?
Well, fortunately, I was in the New York City school system, and we had a great music program. They don't any longer. Most school systems do not, and that's very unfortunate, and that's very sad.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish there was something that we, who are carrying the torch, could do to turn that around. But every single day I get bad news, like an orchestra has folded or the board has decided not to renew a contract or this and that. I don't want to dwell on that. But I was very fortunate going through Brooklyn. I went to public school and then out to Long Island. I was from Merrick, Long Island, and I was exposed to some really great music. We had some really great ensembles. And throughout that time, I was always playing the piano. I was not a jazz guy. I was not really exposed to jazz through my parents. My mother was a Bobby Soxer, and she was also a Glenn Miller fan, a rabid fan.
I like her. I like her because that's my style, too.
Well, great. And I'll tell the story then.
Okay.
She saved the scrapbook back in the 1940s when everybody was off to war. She had not met my father yet. And in the scrapbook were lists of concerts that they played that were broadcast on live radio, like from St. Louis or Kansas City or wherever they were, and the order of the songs they played. And she saved every photo, 8x10, of every person in the band. And I have that scrapbook. So later on, fast forward through many stories and many years, I'm touring with Frank Sinatra, with Liza Minnelli. Well, actually, at this time it was with Dean Martin and with Sammy Davis. And I meet up with a sax player in the band by the name of Al Klink. Al Klink was the fellow who played the jazz solo on In the Mood in the Glenn Miller band.
I love that. That's my favorite of all the songs.
He didn't like to be reminded of that all the time because that's, you know, you got to play it just like that for the rest of your life. Kind of like Tiny Tim's Tiptoe Through the Tulips.
Yeah.
But he was a marvelous man, a marvelous musician, and one of the sweetest guys. So at the time, it was 1989, I told him of my mother's plight. She was dying of lung cancer at the time, and it was not good. It was not a good experience, and it was a really rough time for her. And I told him that she was a devoted Glenn Miller fan, loved him, loved all the cats in the band. And without asking for him to do anything, he mailed to her an autographed copy of the sheet music to In the Mood. And it was amazing when she got it. She was so thrilled. She was so excited. And beyond that, he went and donated a pint of blood on her behalf.
Oh, my gosh.
And he was, like, the greatest guy. And I got to tour with him all around the world. So that's just one story.
That's a great story. To me, it's musical history. And, you know, that's something that would be great if all of the musicians that lived through those time periods got together and did a movie or a book or something to preserve those memories. I mean, is doing a book something that you would be thinking about?
Well, I'm actually working on that. I have a ton of stories. I've played for a ton of people. I've been very fortunate that way. And from my point of view, I'm kind of like a Mel Brooksian guy. I take music very seriously. I want to do the best I can and make the performer do the best they can and feel as comfortable as possible using myself as an accompanist or myself as a soloist. And I've got tons and tons of stories, and some of them are just not tellable on the radio.
Gotcha. Okay, can't share them on this network anyway, right?
Some of them.
Okay. Well, let's go back a little bit. When you said you were taking lessons, and I know you said you did study classical, how did you... But you do jazz. How did that develop? Because, you know, I also play piano. And so when I was a kid, you were taught to read classical music, read popular music. There was not a lot of improvisation. And so as a result, that hindered me throughout my years on the jazz end. So maybe you can explain a little bit from a musician's perspective how that worked for you.
Well, I have a unique viewpoint as to how that happened and a unique evolution. When I was very young, I didn't know anything. I had great ears. I have perfect pitch. So anything I hear, I could play on the piano. And I didn't realize that that was unusual either until I was like in 11th grade in high school when the choir director asked me to give him a note. And I did it, and he went to the piano, and it was right, and everybody went, ooh. And he said to me, Tassoff, why didn't you tell me you have perfect pitch? And I said, because I thought everybody did.
Right. Yeah, because you grew up that way, so you thought everyone else had the same thing you did.
It never came up before. So anyway, I'd sit at the piano from age four on and just improvise, go into my own world to shut out the outside world. And it was improvisatory music. It wasn't jazz. It had no structure. It had no form. And in traditional classical lessons, you don't really learn theory. You don't really learn the chords. You learn how to play scales. You learn what keys you're in. But you don't really learn how to take apart all the music that's in front of you when you have music put in front of you that you're learning how to read. And when you learn how to read music, it's just like any other language. If you're very young, it's much easier. It just comes quickly, like Chinese. I mean, Chinese is an exceptionally difficult language as an adult to learn how to read.
Right.
But when you're a little kid, it's a piece of cake. And music is pretty much the same way. So I had these teachers that didn't teach me any theory at all, just the basics, arpeggios, keys, and scales, but not how to analyze, like, the lines of Bach, who was, like, the absolute genius of classical music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he lived to be very old, and he lived to write an enormous amount of material. And all of it is pretty much in his same inimitable style. And if you could spend an entire lifetime analyzing his music. It just came so natural to him to have up to four voices and even more written and played contrapuntally, existing as their own voice. Now, that didn't happen again for a long, long time until jazz came along. So Bach is a real innovator, and then Art Tatum is an innovator in terms of piano, because nobody ever came close or has to this day the chops and the musicality of Art Tatum as a pianist, even though his style is based on the time that he lived. It's a much older style and a much more traditional style, but he was certainly the best at anything he ever did. So as I got older, I learned by ear to play songs, and I was very bored with classical music. So what you're talking about is learning how to play jazz. There's a line that I talk about where classical people are afraid to cross. They think or believe or are taught that music is on the printed page, and although the notes are there, and sometimes the instructions on how to play those notes are there, the music is not there. How to interpret music, how to make things lyrical, how to voice things, how to make the melody a little bit louder than the second voice and the third voice and the fourth voice, or to bring out the fourth voice or the third voice or the second voice. Teachers can teach you that, but they can't teach you how to cross the line and get out of the page and make your own interpretation of the music. So I find that classical music, for the most part, even though it's great music, is nothing more than the last improvisation of a great composer written down and put on the page. It was at one time in improvisation, and then it becomes frozen, as we say in the Broadway world. So people all have to play those same notes forever and ever and ever. And then you have a classical music world where people know the literature, and they sit in the audience and listen to the performers, and they're able to critique how you play it. Well, for me, that wasn't for me. I did do what the teachers told me to do, and I actually, at the age of seven, was a quarter finalist in the WQXR Young People's Competition Contest. And I went in and I played the Kabalevsky Youth Concerto. And my accompanist was another pianist who was not good at reading, and he kept screwing up. So I made him stop in the middle, and I wound up playing both parts. And I got to the end, and they gave me a nice little certificate, quarterfinalist. And that was pretty much the end of my classical music career until college, in which I majored in classical music. So that's a little
story. Very interesting, because that's a whole other conversation. Is, you know, the classical is really chords and scales, or broken chords and scales. There's still a structure to that music, but you're correct, it's whatever's written on that page. And, you know, there are different schools of thought, like, for example, you know, in a Mozart sonata, if they are repeating the first section, some teachers will say, hey, that first section is played exactly the same way twice. And then there's the other school, which I think I believe more now, is those composers were show-offs. So they would play that section two different times. But they do relate to each other. But you were able to break out of the box in the jazz end of it. So I want to go to a short break, because when we come back, we're going to play some of your music.
Oh, great.
All right. Stay with us.
Central Payment, your number one credit card merchant service provider in the industry, providing e-commerce solutions, POS systems, standalone terminals, mobile apps, and much more. Call Central Payment's James Carner at 813-777-4332. Looking for the lowest rates in the industry and number one customer service? Call Central Payment's James Carner at 813-777-4332. That's James Carner, 813-777-4332.
Do you suffer from back, neck, or body pain? Do you suffer from migraines or have jaw or face pain? Has conventional medicine failed you? Were you injured or in an accident? Call chiropractic physician Dr. Dan Maddock at 813-935-1664. Dr. Dan has helped thousands of patients gain relief for more than 30 years. Dr. Dan is caring, gentle, and takes his time with each patient. He's also a past president of the International Craniopathic Society, a special certification of only 300 chiropractors worldwide. Dr. Dan helps patients from the neck up and the neck down. Dr. Dan accepts most insurance plans. Don't continue to live in pain. Call 813-935-1664. Today. That's 813-935-1664, and get on track to better health.
On the world of Lori Zook, my special guest today for the Masters and Legends special, Russ Kassoff. Russ, tell me a bit about that. I enjoyed that. It started out kind of slow, and then all of a sudden we're jumping.
Well, it's part of an arrangement that I created. That song, Look for the Silver Lining by Jerome Kern, is a very fresh song, yet it's over 100 years old. And I just try to exude a freshness to attract the listener and bring them in so I can share however I feel when I'm playing with them. And that's always been my goal as a solo performer. And when I did that recording in 2005, the end of 2005, another long story, I won't tell it, but the punchline is that I had waited a long time to be able to do my first CD as a soloist, as a leader, and I have an incredible trio with my with that recording. it was at a time that my father was very ill, and I wanted to finish it. I really wanted to finish it before he died, and I missed it by 2 weeks. And at the end of the CD, you'll hear Where Have All the Flowers Gone, and I needed one more song to record to make it a full CD, and I was desperately looking for one, trying to find songs that mean something to me, something where the lyrics and the music are equal, something that tells a story. And I was sitting in a diner with my wife about 3 weeks before we went to the studio, and it came on in the background. And I said to myself, I hadn't heard that song in years. And I live in an area near where Pete Seeger lived, and he sang that song. And I looked it up, and I read the lyric. And the lyric is so spiritual and soulful and so apropos of what my father's condition was at the time, and I was so emotionally connected to it, that's a solo piano recording, that after I did the CD release, I never played it again, because it made me cry, it made people in the audience cry. I knew I made my point, and I knew it touched the right people, and it was a very emotional CD to record. So all of the songs have that certain kind of freshness and that certain kind of message. Hope and promise is what I'm thinking.
Anyway. Yeah, and one of the things from listening to your music, you know, when you listen to different musicians, some of them are very emotional, and I think that's what makes it. If they can translate that, I don't even think they have to translate it. I think it's just naturally, it comes out in the music that they play. Whereas some people who perform, you don't hear that quite as much. So it makes me question, are they as emotionally deep, I guess would be a good way of saying it, as you know, as someone who, you know what I'm saying? I'm trying to compare someone who is very emotional. It comes out beautifully. Someone who's not, it just comes out flat and monotone.
Well, I wouldn't say that anybody's not in the right place with their heart when they're playing music. I will say that because the greatest number of people that participate in music today are in the world of academia, that is the business of music. And people learn how to be virtuosos on their instruments. I remember you talking about this a little bit with Glenn Zottola in your interview with him. They come out knowing how to be very virtuosic, totally adept at their instruments, but they don't learn from the masters, the older cats, the people that came before, how to convert that into music. And thus, the audience is not as exposed to that as they used to be back in the old days, when they could just sit there and be taken over by people playing or singing by lyric, like Sinatra. Whatever Sinatra sang, he was magic. Whatever somebody like Stan Getz or Paul Desmond or Clark Terry played, beautiful players, they just, you had to have your mind and your heart open to receive that. But the point that you make is very well taken. It is what exists today. It's very hard to fight the sea of, let's say, mediocrity. It's not really mediocrity, but it's uninformed, educated musicians who don't know yet how to evolve into actually playing music and sharing it with people.
Right, but I think that's what you're taught in school. I went to school for music myself, and so they're teaching you how to be the best at your instrument, but not really how to break out of the box to do it that way.
Yeah.
You know, and part of that too, though, like you discussed earlier, and I'm from your area, the school systems, at least up there in the north, do still have some music programs. I'm in Florida, where these kids, they don't really get involved in music, maybe violin to start on in elementary school, but there is really nothing until maybe junior high school or high school. There are no music programs, or if they are, they're extracurricular. You know, they have to go somewhere to be in a show, you know, if they're going to do some type of a musical. And I think that the way, you know, music and art has been cut out of the school system has affected the creativity for kids. And also, as I'm sure you well know, being a musician, that helps your brain fire up those neurons, and that's what makes somebody smarter. There's been plenty of testing to prove that, and yet we're now lacking that. Was that a mouthful?
Yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, you can talk for weeks about this. I don't understand Well, it comes down to money and budgets of school systems and whose agenda is the most important. I don't understand why it's never been accepted in this country, or it hasn't been that accepted, to include music and the arts, for all that matter, in growing up in school and going to school and being exposed to all the great music and art that has come now and before. And in Europe and Japan, that is not the case. They still appreciate great music of all kinds and great art of all kinds and great writing of all kinds. But it's very different here.
Yeah, I agree. But at least, again, and you're being in the North, there's still more kids exposed to it than when you're in a southern state or maybe a western state. When you're outside a major metropolitan area, you just don't have culture. You don't have those things to go see. You know, you don't have Lincoln Center. You don't have the real Broadway anyway. You just don't have it. And I think that makes it more difficult. Now, I wanted to ask you, I know in your younger years, you've done everything. You worked on cruise ship. You did Windows on the World. You worked in the Catskill Mountains. For aspiring musicians that may be listening, how did you land these gigs? And were they gigs that you liked doing?
Well, it was an exciting time. It was in my liner notes of my forthcoming CD. I talk about hope and promise and how those things were instilled in me by my parents. And that was the time of America. That was the time of our society. Everybody was trying to find the American dream and grow and figure out what it was they were going to do. And back then, there were so many opportunities. In the Catskills, there were like tons of hotels that had bands. Some had three bands, four bands. Some had just a Latin band. Some had a show band and a lounge band and a Latin band. And those opportunities were there. These days, due to the lack of education in most of the school systems, even in the big cities, and the much lesser opportunities that are afforded to young people, I'm always saying that the biggest industry of music these days is academia. And that's why people get teaching degrees. I myself got a performance degree. I'm a proud graduate of the Crane School of Music, State University College at Potsdam. It's right up the road, about 400 miles. I just wanted to get as far away from my home life as I could and still be in the New York State school system.
Right.
And they're still going strong, and they've produced some really great alumni, most prominently Renee Fleming. She was an undergrad there, and lots of Broadway people and lots of opera people and lots of jazz people. But today, what would I say to young kids? I just don't know, because it's hard enough for us older people to get gigs. There still are fringe and underground places to play, and we did all that when we were growing up. But we graduated to the bigger clubs, of which now there are clean. Mm-hmm. And there is no Catskills anymore, and there is no Windows on the World, and there is no having little bands or little groups playing in hotel lobbies. There are some very rare exceptions, but it has really dried up. It has really changed, and the folks of my generation and older have done an awful lot of work trying to keep the torch and keep it alive and give opportunity to the younger folks. And in New York City, fortunately, we have the Broadway world, and if you can break into that, that's a very dignified and nice gig to have. As long as you understand, it's almost like playing classical music. It's 8 shows a week, and you have to play it exactly the same.
Over and over.
Yep. But it's a great job. If you have that job, you get pension, you get health. There are area standards, and you are afforded a great deal of dignity. The opportunities that I had when I was younger, and by being in the right place at the right time, managed to hook up with Sinatra and with Liza. And nowadays, I'm with Rita Moreno, and she's doing great at the age of 84, and we'll be working again soon in the fall. Those opportunities were very, very different. If you hooked up with a gig like that, you were like part of family. Everybody respected each other. You had a role. You felt comfortable. You were paid well. It was a great life. In the case of Sinatra and Liza and Rita and those kinds of stars, it's a first-class gig. I mean, it's indescribable to people who have never done that. I can't possibly explain to you what it was like to sit down and play for Frank Sinatra. I mean, I only have that experience in my mind. I could write a book. I could write a poem. I could try to make you feel as if you were there. But then at the same time, if you were also there in the audience, you had your own magical experience. So I'm very fortunate to have been able to do that. And that stuff is no longer in play today. There aren't people like that are touring, that are working all the time, except for like Engelbert Humperdinck and Tom Jones, those kind of guys. They're still working their butts off.
Yeah, they're still pretty popular, too. Well, what I want to do, Russ, we want to play another one of your songs. So hold on for just a second.
Okay.
Okay, now that was the song you were speaking about.
Yes.
Which is going to make me cry now, Russ. Because that was beautiful interpretation of the song.
Well, the thing I'd like to emphasize about that song and all songs that have great lyrics and tell a very powerful message story is that I think of the lyrics when I'm playing. That makes me unique as an accompanist. When I'm playing for vocalists, as an accompanist, which is a whole different art form, in order to make them feel as comfortable as possible and not have to worry about anything that goes around behind them, you have to earn their confidence that you're going to be right there like a pad for them and play exactly the right thing for them to tell their story as a vocalist. And when you're sitting there playing a song that has an equally powerful lyric, even if it's just an instrumental, as are these solo CDs that I have, I'm thinking of the lyric, and I'm playing the melody and the improvisations as if I were singing it. So it's a unique approach in that it's not taught in school. People are not taught how to be accompanists. There's no curriculum for that. And when I do master classes, I demonstrate to singers and their accompanists how they can become one more better. Is that a good phrase? More better?
Yeah, more better. I like that. Well, I don't want you to go anywhere because I still have more questions for you and we have more music to play for you. So stay
great
with us. Are you looking for an affordable way to advertise to thousands of consumers nationally? If you own a business and didn't think you could afford radio advertising, you need to call me, Lori Zook, host of the nationally syndicated radio show, The World of Lori Zook. My show reaches thousands of people on 29 AM and FM stations nationwide, as well as through the internet. Additionally, your commercials will also be heard on all of my podcasts and throughout social media sites. Don't wait another minute. Call me at 813-777-4908, 813-777-4908, and let me bring your message to the nation and to help you gain more exposure.
Do you suffer from back, neck, or body pain? Do you suffer from migraines or have jaw or face pain? Has conventional medicine failed you? Were you injured or in an accident? Call chiropractic physician Dr. Dan Maddock at 813-935-1664. Dr. Dan has helped thousands of patients gain relief for more than 30 years. Dr. Dan is caring, gentle, and takes his time with each patient. He's also a past president of the International Craniopathic Society, a special certification of only 300 chiropractors worldwide. side. Dr. Dan helps patients from the neck up and the neck down. Dr. Dan accepts most insurance plans. Don't continue to live in pain. Call 813-935-1664 today. That's 813-935-1664. And get on track to better health.
And welcome back to the world of Lori Zook. I have musician Russ Kassoff with me. And Russ, we were speaking a little bit, you were saying you were teaching, and you touched on something because we both know musician Glenn Zatola. And one thing he always says is when he plays, it's as if he's singing through the horn. And I understand that because when I play piano, I hear, you know, if I'm playing, I hear the band or the vocalist in my head, but I just feel the power of putting into the music my feeling. So first, I'd like to know how you know Glenn Zatola, since he is a mutual friend. And second, what do you think about that singing through the horn analogy?
Well, first, I love that. And I can say that I haven't seen Glenn in many years, probably over 20 years. But when he lived in New York, we used to do club dates together, and I always recognized him as one of the best musicians that I knew. He was very unique. He was like, well, who plays saxophone and trumpet?
Right,
well,
right.
I mean, that's so bizarre. And then I heard on your show he say that nobody ever told him you can't do that. So that's, you know, kind of like what I was when I was a kid. There are no rules unless you let people make the rules and impose them upon you.
Yes.
And so for all these years, we've been in touch back and forth, Facebooks and emails, and I've heard his latest recordings, and they're just great. And when you attach it to the thought that he's singing through the horn, I call that being one with the music. I call that every note that I play or try to play is made of every fiber of my being. There's unless I'm distracted by some woman who comes up to me and says, could you play something from Fiddler on the Roof? in the middle.
Right.
But
that would be me,
playing,
Russ. It would. It would.
But when I'm playing, and this happens in the classical world and in the jazz world, I could think of a great sax player by the name of Jerry Dodgen, who's probably about 82 right now. And every time I see him play, it's just like what Glenn describes. Everything he does to produce the sound that comes out of his saxophone is every fiber of his being. He's not only singing, he's just one with it. And that is the ultimate goal of being a musician. And you can't learn that. You really can't learn that. You have to experience it. And when you do experience it, you don't need anything else. That's as good as it gets. That's nirvana.
Gotcha. Well, thanks for sharing that. And I wanted to let Lee Clark here at WDCF had a question for you.
Got to make sure I have the right microphone. You mentioned playing with Sinatra before, Russ, and you kind of piqued my interest. And I was wondering, you know, a musician such as yourself, it must have been, you know, quite an honor to sit down and, I'm assuming, play live with Sinatra. And so could you tell us, what was that like to sit down with, you know, perhaps the all-time greatest singer of our century and, you know, play piano? What was going through your mind? Was it... What were you nervous? Or what exactly was that like?
Okay, next question.
Yeah, I know, because you said you didn't want to. There was no way to describe it, so now I'm asking you to describe it.
I'll try. The long story, I can't tell. We don't have enough time. But how to get to the gig and be on the first gig, for me it was in my birthday week in August of 1980. And I would have been becoming 28 years old. I was driving from Wolf Trap, where I had just done a gig with Mimi Hines and Tony Martin, Sid Charisse, Anna Marie Alberghetti, and Roberta Sherwood. I've never mentioned this before. That's why it's fresh in my mind. Anyway, I'm driving all the way to Atlantic City, and we're playing at Resorts International on a floor that was built just for him. So all of his 40-something piece orchestra and all of his staff could stay on that floor and have access to the gym and the Olympic-sized swimming pool and, of course, the magnificent nightclub, which they made just for him. So I'm sitting at the piano And this was right after the Trilogy album was recorded. And that album was the last real studio album that he ever did in 1979. And I'm looking at the music, and the music is not difficult. I mean, my story includes the fact that when I was a paperboy, I took all my money and bought Sinatra albums, and that's how I got to start. And when I arrived on the gig and he walked into the room, I just was overcome by greatness. I mean, this is Frank Sinatra. This is somebody that is a cultural icon at so many levels for so many people in the world. And I didn't realize how high up he was in the food chain for idolization. He walks in the room, it's magic. It's total magic. It turns everybody into
mush.
Better than they are. I'm talking not only about the musicians, but the stagehands and the crew and the management. Everybody, it's as if they just got their shoes shined. I mean, they're looking up, and he's commanding 100% of your attention, and he's deserving of it. I mean, it's just as if, you know, I don't want to say Jesus, but something like
yeah.
that walks into the room, and the beauty of it is once you realize where you are and what you're doing, and once he takes a look at you and you become part of his family, everything in life is okay. You're part of the family. He respects you. He admires what you're doing. And think of it as a giant jigsaw puzzle. Everything is a little piece, like the French horns, the oboe, the different reed players that play all the doubles, the string players who take off from the New York Philharmonic to play for him, things like that, the harpist. I mean, everything is, like, unbelievable. It was the I was fortunate to get kind of like the last 10 years of the greatest of the showbiz era that he was the king of. He was the chairman of the board. That's what they called him. And you would look at the drummer. His name was Irv Kotler, and he was one of a kind. He wasn't a person that you would seek out to hear him play. He was a piece of the puzzle that when you put all the pieces together, made the magic. You stir the pot. You put all the ingredients in, and it came out unbelievable. And so for me to sit at the piano and he sings, "I've Got You Under My Skin," and all I have to do is, that's it. And I happen to be sitting at a piano this whole
right.
time waiting for you to ask me to play.
Play, but, yes.
But, you know, there's not a whole lot to play for him. It's all part of the orchestration, the Don Costa orchestration, the Nelson Riddle orchestration, whoever was the orchestrator of the particular chart, which... for some reason, those orchestrations were always better than when those arrangers wrote for other people. And it was just magic. I always call it the magic. And nobody else has anything like it or had anything like it. I will say that some people came pretty close that I've worked with, like Sammy Davis and Dean Martin and Liza, and even Rita Moreno, who's still going. But it's very... there's only one Frank Sinatra, and... there's only one level of that magic. And even if you're just sitting in the audience and you have no idea what it takes to play second tenor or third trumpet or to stand up and play a solo in the middle of one of his charts, you just are mesmerized by this magic that has taken over you. And so it's kind of like an all-equal experience, however you want to open your eyes. And that's the best that I can...
I think that's a great description. We're both looking here going, you know, to me it sounds electrical. Awe would be the word. I'd be in awe of some a situation like that. Now, I know that, Russ, you also, you conduct, you produce, you arrange. So we're going to play The Best Is Yet to Come.
Out of the tray of life, it just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started to hum. Still, it's a real good bet. The best is yet to come.
Russ, tell us about that song, The Best Is Yet to Come.
Well, The Best Is Yet to Come is part of a project I did with the vocalist, Catherine Dupuis, who also happens to sing with my big band, the Russ Kassiloff Big Band, and also happens to be a business partner and collaborator for the Jazz PA Summer Fun Celebration Festival in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania, which we've been doing for 11 years, and have had some great solo artists as our guests. And this year it's going to be on July 30th in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania. That particular project was a labor of love. I arranged all the tunes. Some of them are original. And the band includes people like Marvin Stamm and Ted Nash. Ted Nash is with the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. Marvin Stamm was one of the original members of the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Orchestra at the Village Vanguard. And Bucky Pizzarelli's on the album. There's some real greats on it. And it's a demonstration of my arranging skills and orchestrating and producing. We put the whole thing together, and it's been very successfully critically acclaimed. So that's about that. The Best Is Yet to Come by itself was the very last thing that Frank Sinatra sang live at the Palm Springs Desert Golf Tournament in 1996, I believe it was. He never sang in public again, and it's inscribed on his tombstone.
That's a good story. Tell me about your life. Like, what is a day like in your life? Because you sound like a busy guy. You're doing, you have your own band. You play solo. You know, you do the producing, the arranging, the conducting. You host a radio show. Tell me about that.
That's called The Jazz Deli with Russ Kassiloff. It's on WFDU HD2. And it's on Saturday mornings live from 10 to noon. And our motto is, our tongue sandwiches speak for themselves. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
And what that's about is for me to share what music has come into my life. It's usually 1 or 2 degrees of separation of everything I play. I've got a story for every cut, every track I play. And most of it is from my personal record collection that goes all the way back to the 60s. And it's an incredible lot of fun to play. And sometimes we have a theme show, like our friend Frank Jr. just passed away last week.
Yeah.
And I did a nice tribute to him. And in order to introduce the tribute, I played the track, this is something you should listen to if you're not aware of it, on the Trilogy album. Frank Sr. sang a song which the lyric is a conversation between a father and a son, and it's called That's What God Looks Like to Me. And you cannot help but cry when you listen to that and you're thinking about this particular event of the loss of one of the last connections to this great art form and great American songbook, who I consider to be the best of preserving it. And there are a lot of Sinatra imitators or wannabes, very heartfelt, very soulful, but no one came as close to honoring it and sounding like his old man as Frank Jr. did.
Good.
He was a very kind and nice man.
Now, the CDs that you have, do you want to talk about them? We've got a couple minutes.
Sure. The first one is called Somewhere, and it's with a wonderful trio, Martin Wind on the bass and Tim Horner on the drums. And the second one is called Bird Fly By, and it's got my current trio, Jay Anderson on the bass, who's just been on a Grammy-winning, two Grammy-winning CDs by Maria Schneider of her jazz orchestra. One of them was with David Bowie. He recorded a tune called Sue, and that won a Grammy last year. And then my drummer, who is actually the reincarnation of Thad Jones as a writer and Mel Lewis as a drummer, is named Dennis McCrell. And we just recorded another CD called I Can Dream, which will be out early summer. And you can access them through my website. You go to cdbaby.com and search my name, Russ Kassiloff, R-U-S-S-K-A-S-S-O-F-F. And you can find out anything you want about me and my upcoming live dates at my website, which is RussKassiloff.com.
Now, last question for you, Russ. What would be your favorite song or songs? I know most musicians have more than one. What are your favorites?
I can't answer that. I mean, it's the same 10,000 songs over and over again.
Well, that's right. I think I'm going to have to do another show with you because I have a lot more questions for you, and we'll cover this on the next show, but on your CD with the bird, I want to know the story behind that because it's a funny picture. But I want to thank you very much for joining me today. How can you be reached?
Well, you can send an email to my website. My webmail is Russ, R-U-S-S, at RussKassiloff.com. That's R-U-S-S-K-A-S-S-O-F-F.com. There's all kinds of stuff on the website. You can read about the big band, where we're playing. usually in places that are religious experiences. We play the Baha'i Center in New York and at St. Peter's in the Citicorp Center, which is a wonderful place. And that's the best way to reach me.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you again for joining me. We'll have to do a show number two, I think. I want to hear some of those stories. So will you join me again in the future?
Absolutely.
All right. Very good. Thanks, Russ. And we're signing off. You can hear us again next week, same time, same channel.